Not only then, but even later in South America, when I assumed that pre-Columbian art could be related to one and the same early civilization, only today do I know that there is an analogy with the unknown planet Itibiratu and earlier visits by people from that planet. Of course, at the time in India I thought this out in terms of allegory and symbolism, reflecting that perhaps this Itibiratu, the strange man had mentioned, might be their equivalent of the mythical Shangri-La or other romantical nonsense. At the back of my mind was the thought that there must be a commercial reason for this invitation, and I expected some sales talk from my host. At least mentally I prepared myself, however nothing of the sort happened. Satura did not want me to buy old religious paintings nor anything else. We spent a very agreeable afternoon together. Having viewed the interesting rooms of exhibition, we went outside into the garden. There, I was able to observe the strange man even better than during our trip from Bombay to Madras. He had the light brown skin of a Eurasian, huge dark eyes, a rather small mouth and an unusual chin line. The lower part of the jaw looked slightly deformed. Then, there were those fingertip gloves which he seemed to wear at all times, even though the weather was extremely hot. Above all, there was this peculiarity of speech, this complete reliance upon an electronic gadget to reproduce his voice. If it had not been for this, I certainly would have placed him as the religious leader of some sect, like the Trappists, who make a vow of silence. Perhaps, I thought, he had made such a vow of silence and yet had also provided a built-in escape mechanism from that vow by linking the vocal cords with an electronic speaking device that bypassed the mouth, thus giving a semblance of credence to the original vow of silence. Utterly ridiculous. But have not the early Christians emasculated themselves so that their virility would not come between themselves and their devotions to God? Others have blinded and scourged themselves all in the name of religion. For a second I thought that my host could have come from another part of India, as he had got on the train at Bombay and was making a pilgrimage to one of the holy cities of his particular religion, but then again he spoke about his home on another planet and continued to ask me questions, mostly about Europe. I was thus thrown once more into utter confusion. Also, he asked me what my name means, and told him, but then I recalled my impoliteness while being on the train. One had forgotten to introduce myself. "You know who I am, then?" I had remarked, and Satura smiled. "Most things et simple, when we analyze them, your name was printed on your luggage tag." We continued to talk for a while and I mentioned my intention to see Kashmir in the northern part of India. "Then," I said, "I would travel back to Calcutta by plane and fly up to Benares, which is only a very short flight from Calcutta." "That would make an excellent tour," my friend replied and added, "Benares, the holiest of all cities, shall be the place where we meet again." What made him think that our paths would cross again? "Maybe this will indicate our presence in Benares," he said and showed me a curious ring. Made of solid gold, at least half an inch thick. "This ring," he informed me, "is the symbol of a human religion very close to ours. It is many times 10,000 years old." I looked at the ring more closely. In the middle of it was a minute scrap of metal that sparkled like a diamond. "Mr. Satura pointed to the metal design and assured me that because of it we would be able to meet again. Then he handed me the ring and told me not to lose it. Briefly, I had hesitated to take such a strange present." We had walked across the patio of the colonial mansion to the drive that led down to the road. "I know that it is unusual to say the least, to receive such a magnificent gift, especially on such a chance acquaintance," and I looked at Satura. But he was smiling gently on me. Reassured, I slipped the ring on my finger, and thanked him, inadequately enough. For the present. There was one question I had wanted to ask Mr. Satura since I met him the first time on the train. The gift of the ring, the symbol of religion, I dared to think of his regard for me, emboldened me to ask, "Would you please," I said, "tell me your profession?" Satura smiled once more. "I am a servant," he replied, "a servant of God, as are all my people." With that, He gave me a friendly wave of the hand and returned to the mansion. I ambled along the pavement until a taxi came my way. There is little point in describing my visit to Kashmir, suffice it that I managed to study some magnificent temples, and enthused over the various art forms with which the temples were decorated. I do not want to seem impious when I confess that I was more interested in the ceremonial of religion than in the religion itself. I had been told so much already, in Bombay, about Benares, the holy town on the Ganges where they go to die, that I remained only 2 short days in Kashmir and flew back to Calcutta and then to Benares. Benares, I shall never forget this town, Benares, because it was there I finally understood the true aspects of death and the very meaning of life itself. In India, of course, there is not much guessing, the ultimate meaning of life is love and death. Where there is love, there is also death. There is no escape from the two, and in order to live fully, one must at some point in life experience real love, real passionate love, and also the direct danger of death. Without an awareness of these two, life can have no meaning. Indeed, if is the vital clue to the erotica with which so many of the Indian temples are embellished. By death, I do not mean the death that comes at the end of the physical life. Death is that which looks you straight in the face, the reverse of the coin of love. Of course, this love and death that is life do not have much in common, except, perhaps, that both passion and death pass on, for they are both in a very great hurry. In India, physical death is never very far away. Perhaps that is the way that nature orders things. The astonishing rate of increase of the population is apparently linked in many aspects to the closeness of life to death. Indeed, to observe nature makes one believe this to be true. A few miserable grasshoppers have a better time than the giant swarms, numbering countless millions, which in their fury devastate everything that comes in their path. Once they have filled their stomachs, made love and laid a few eggs, their life comes to an end. So by analogy, the more people who populate this planet Earth, the nearer that population will be to disaster. The rich nations, with decent homes and hospitals, with well-adjusted, conservatively dressed, Philistine communities, will never know what it is to have millions of starving, uneducated, super-religious fanatics running half-naked through some of the largest areas of the world. But make no mistake about it. The struggle to live of these starving millions is as violent as their death. So I discovered in my journey across the length and breadth of India, that life and death are cheap. Funereal customs are as beggarly as is life for the average Indian. The corpse, naked under a small sheet, is placed upon a stack of logs, and the fire is left to do its work. A fat old man burns much faster than a skinny old woman, so that funeral workers, attending to the last rites, mark up their price when dealing with the poor. So even in death, poverty remains a curse. But there is logic in the demand. The body burners know that the fat man's body will not need much wood, but the skinny person's body will take an hour and a half to be consumed, and a lot of wood will be needed. You simply have to be practical, even in the matter of death. You must see the problem from the point of view of the body burners. I discovered, however, many more pleasant things in Benares than the riverside crematoria, however important these might be to the religious and economic life of the community. There is, for example, an excellent hotel, the only one approved of by Western people. I checked in at this hotel, and admired not only the accommodation but also the beautiful gardens made all the more splendid by the tropical trees dotted about. On the night of the second day after I had checked into Benares and into this hotel, I was enjoying the night air in the garden. Suddenly, I noticed that the metal design in the middle of the gold ring that Satura had given me in Madras was shining with a luster that far outshone the natural glitter of the metal. It must have been a trick of the light. That is what I immediately told myself. A piece of metal just does not glow incandescently of its own volition. It had to be a trick of the light, an optical illusion. I tested out this hypothesis by moving my hand so that the moonlight and the light from the battery of lamps struck the metal design from every conceivable angle. The result was the same. That scrap of metal glowed as if it was a miniature searchlight. I even tried putting the ring in my pocket, where there could be no possibility for reflected light. The metal design, if anything, glowed even more brightly. A mental image of Satyrak came before me, his words, that the ring would announce his presence, flooded into my mind. The whole thing was ridiculous. It just could not happen. But there it was, happening in front of my very eyes. Up till now, I had looked upon Satyrak with a very open mind. If I had been a religious man, I suppose I would have been in the position of an honest agnostic. Satyrak might have been, or might not have been what I thought him to be, a holy mystic belonging to some small religious sect of which I had never heard, but that ring, with its metal inset shining so brightly at me, put an entirely different complexion on the matter. I was sitting in the grounds of the hotel facing the main entrance. This entrance was brilliantly lit. Many people were standing on the steps leading to the entrance. Because of my own position with respect to the lights, it would have been impossible for anybody at that entrance to see me sitting in what must have been to them the darkness of the grounds. A little after 9:30, I saw the unmistakable figure of Satyrak appear at the entrance of the hotel. It would have been the natural thing for him to inquire for me at the desk. Instead, he passed through the entrance out into the grounds and walked straight to where I was sitting in a secluded, darkened spot. He came to me as though he had been linked in some way to a homing device. Satyrak greeted me warmly. He seemed very pleased to see me and inquired if I had enjoyed my visit to the temples of Kashmir. So I started to tell him about my holiday jaunt, took him over to the light, and showed him some photographs which I had taken on the trip. Most of the photographs had a religious motif. There were interiors and exteriors of temples, colored slides of many different effigies to the numerous gods worshipped in those temples, pictures of priests and worshippers, the whole spectrum of what one would expect to find when making such a holiday trip. My friend hesitated very much to look at the faces of the people pictured on the photos, but suddenly he must have changed his mind, and looked at them carefully before handing them back to me. "You have been there?" I inquired. "Yes, I have been to these places of worship. But you know, my friend, religion is blind. Just like love." He said this very sadly, as though he were reluctant to pass any criticisms on religion. After we had finished with the photographs, we sat down on a bench near to the main entrance where we could observe the comings and goings of the bystanders. A group of uniformed hotel servants loitered around the entrance practicing the international sport of girl watching, a pastime that is not only international but also historical. The Spanish conquistadors did it in Cuzco, the Romans in Gaul. It docks not Matu one little bit if the girls are ugly or pretty, of low, middle or high class, if kitchen maid or hotel guest, men will watch them. We saw a young airline hostess, chic and pretty as a picture, walk down the stairs and have a word with the hotel manager. The girl watchers reacted as if she was the seventh wonder of the world. Satyrak noted this intense reaction, and smiled his amusement. "What men won't do for the sight of a pretty face and figure," he remarked. "It is the same in all the universe. It is a powerful force." I agreed. "Why?" "I once saw a riot sparked off because of it."